What is it about life that is the older you get, the more time you spend looking back? Well, we found the same thing happens with podcasting. And as we've gotten better at this and our audience has gotten bigger, some of you might not have heard or found our early episodes. As we near 150 episodes, it can be a bit of a pain in the backside to scroll that far back in your app. So we're revisiting some of our early favorites, slightly edited, in a new regularly recurring series we call In Case You Missed It. Today we dive into Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe, with author Tara Murtha. This is one of my favorites in the 33 and a third series, and I'm happy to welcome Tara.
Hello, great to be here. Thanks.
So your book on Bobby Gentry's debut album was part of the 33 and a third series. And for our listeners who don't know, that's a pretty competitive series where you really have to present a lot of work on your record and why you want to do a book on that. Can you tell us what your pitch was for the album and why this album?
Sure. I had this in mind for a 33 book for a while, actually. You know, anyone that sort of watches that series, they very occasionally open it for proposals. You know, it's sort of like a 2-week window and then it slams shut again and you kind of never know when that's going to happen. So, of course, it happened at like the most inconvenient time to pull it together. But I had been working on it in an ongoing way, and I actually did a huge grad school project sort of on Bobby Gentry and on the topic. And that was what made me realize that I'd like to do a 33. So I pitched it as what it wound up being, really an investigative pop history. You know I wanted to do a really, that's my background as an investigative reporter and an arts features writer. So I wanted to combine that and do a deep dive and as deep as I could to actually dig up facts about Bobby Gentry and her career. I found it really befuddling that she had this cult status, and I'd listened to the music, of course, and really could just find the same like three little paragraphs for the most part outside of a few articles that just regurgitated this sort of mythical biography. And so I also was acutely aware that people who had worked with her were getting older and that, you know, I was somewhat of a race against time to be able to find contracts and talk with people that would have worked with her. So I just presented it really as a very research heavy investigative pop history to try to figure out, you know, in part why she chose to disappear from the spotlight, but really just to illuminate, you know, her career overall and use the first record as a prism to do that.
Well, as you know, your book was one of my favorites of 33 and a third. I've read several, you know, in fact, quite a few, and I find they can definitely get a little academic. your investigative background really shone through, and, everybody knows Ode to Billy Joe, but the background you presented was just so fascinating.
Oh, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
Yeah, well, let's jump into that. Ironically, you know, one of the things I learned was the single off of that album was Mississippi Delta, which was a whole nother kind of thing musically. It was funky and bluesy and had horns and guitars. Mm-hmm. But it was the disc jockeys that kept spinning the B-side, which of course was Ode to Billy Joe.
Well, so it's really two wildly different songs in style.
Totally.
And with Mississippi Delta, you know, Bobby brought that into Capitol fully formed. The horn section, everything was done. She just handed them the tape, which is pretty wild and pretty indicative to me that she was looking for a hit, you know, that jived with what was on the radio, you know, this real kind of barn burner, soulful stew song. And whereas Ode was not, you know, Ode was one of what she referred to as her regional songs, you know. And it actually got flipped before it got to the DJs, you know, at Capitol. Once Kelly Gordon, the producer, assigned Jimmy Haskell, the composer, to put the strings on top of Ode to slap it on the B-side, they listened to it and realized that it was, you know, more than the sum of its parts at that point. And then he championed it at the next meeting and really argued for this totally bizarre song to get released as the A-side, and not just bizarre sounding and unlike anything else on the radio, but it was, you know, 4 minutes 15 seconds, so it was too long as well. So he really advocated. So by the time it came out, it was the A-side, and it was being, you know, advertised in the little sneak peeks and Billboard and stuff was focused on Ode. But the DJs certainly went picked up on it, and as you know, as the ubiquitous sound of that summer, as some writers have said.
And that was the demo, right, that was released. They added the strings, but wasn't that the demo that she cut?
Yeah, the whole record and that was something that I realized pretty far into the research. You know, people talked about this demo, but after a while I realized, talking to even an engineer at the studio where she had cut it, Mike Deasy, who is a session player that was on Ode, you know, being conducted by Jimmy Haskell, that he described sitting in the room and that, you know, they played for the part that they put on top from Jimmy Haskell, but that she sang like a guiding vocal, but they didn't even recut the vocal. And Jimmy Haskell also confirmed for me, really explicitly said, you know, the demo that we're talking about was the tape. I mean, it wasn't a demo. It was a demo produced, professionally produced with Bobby Paris, as I report in the book, in a professional way, just referred to as the demo. And that was why they were also able to just kind of really put together the whole record pretty quickly and get it out the door once Ode hit as a single. You know, they put it out as a single without any art. Nobody knew what she looked like or who she was. Planning on going into full gear and getting a full LP out so quickly on top of it. But they were able to do so in part because she had the record. She brought it in. You know, everything else was just sweetening sessions, as they called them, putting some sounds on top.
So great when it's fully formed. There's lots of those stories, but you know, nothing quite like Ode to Billy Joe, which was so dark and so sparse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the record that knocked the Beatles' All You Need Is Love out of the number one spot on the Billboard charts, right?
Right.
Pretty amazing. On the one hand, All You Need Is Love, and then you have this really dark tale.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, but they, you know, the production of Ode to Billy Joe, the LP, was highlighted in this huge article in Billboard at the time, showcasing, just as an example, showcasing Capitol's power and having all these different arms of, you know, the record studios and the advertising department, you know, showing it as this powerhouse that was able to get it out the door. And they ordered 500,000 copies, which the previous record of a pre-order for a label in terms of expectation of sales was the Beatles. For Meet the Beatles was 100,000 copies. I mean, they ordered five times the record that they had ever ordered before because that's how huge the single was. And they were right. It, you know, it still sells. So
definitely. And in preparation for this talk here, I went back and listened to that song and it's just incredible. So let's talk about that for a minute. There's a lot to it. One of the many powers I think in it is this nonchalant way that the family's talking about Billy Joe's death. You know, pass the biscuits. I'll have another piece of apple pie.
Yeah. I mean, that Bobby had repeatedly stated that that was really the point of the song, you know, as people obsessed about what was thrown off the bridge, you know, and the plot lines of the song.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
She's long maintained that the entire point, if there had to be a point, she was getting a little bummed out that she, you know, was called to explain it, you know, that the point was really showing the family's kind of disinterest in the young girl, the narrator of the song's experience, and that they are sitting right there at the table and don't even notice that she's that upset. She clearly has a relationship that's not laid out, that's not specified in any way, with Billy Joe, and they just keep on going. And in sort of a macro way, you know, as part of her ongoing critique of Southern culture, I really think a lot about Eudora Welty's short stories, sharing that Southern Gothic point of view that points out that all of these very specific traditions and conventions that are supposed to showcase family loyalty and intimacy are really like weaponized and used to drive people apart. And that was really her point of view.
Yeah, you know, the mother of the narrator in the song, you know, she does notice, she's like, you haven't touched a single bite. And they say, someone saw a girl that looked like you up there with Billy Joe throwing something off the bridge, but yet there's no questions, no answers, no interaction, no empathy.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, her and the narrator and the mom get closer than the brother and the father, right? There's this like shared feminine understanding. But then by the end of the song, by the final verses, her mom lost her father and she still can't. And she lost Billy Joe and they still sort of just float away from each other. You get the sense that they couldn't connect through their respective grief either, even if they can understand that it existed.
And that's a super powerful thing. But of course, and I'm sure you've answered this many times, the million-dollar question is, what were they throwing off the bridge? There's lots of theories out there. You know, for our listeners who haven't investigated it, do you want to run through them?
Sure. There's three major ones, I guess. One's just sort of like a trinket of some kind, you know, a locket or a necklace, a ring to symbolize engagement, and that there's, you know, something to do with a baby. You know, one of the Capitol guys thought that the song was about abortion, so he refused to participate in it. He didn't want Capitol to release it because of that. Very early on, I read, of course, everything I could find, and I found one time Bobby early on said it was a trinket. And then from there on out, she backed up and said, you know, that it would talk about that it didn't matter what it was. You know, and really in a literary sense, it was what's referred to in film as a MacGuffin. Like in Hitchcock movies, there's some main detail of the plot that drives all the plot, but is really incidental and not really not significant to the meaning. Or I think about the suitcase in Pulp Fiction.
Right, right.
So it threads through the whole narrative and it kind of pushes people's actions, but in the end it's pretty incidental, you know, to what it was. And certainly that's what the literary technique was. I think that the real answer is that she told musicians that she was working with when she first got her foot in the door at Capitol, and she was like, oh, I think this record's going to happen for me. You know, I think they're going to record it and release it. And she told Frank Lacuna, who she was in a band called the International Four with, that she was like, and you know what? People are going to think it's a baby and they're going to talk about it.
That's the one that always pops up. The fact that it's not clear, I think, probably added a lot to the appeal of the song. I'm sure there were some, you know, incredible dinner time conversations over what the heck that was.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. She knew, you know, she knew that on a craft level, that leaving it ambiguous was going to be part of the attraction of the song. You know, for people wouldn't be able to resist trying to figure out what it was. People want to know what those young girls are up to, you know.
You know, that's an awfully tough song to top. And talk about one that probably shouldn't be covered. You're listening to All Music Podcasts, a member of Pantheon Media. We're talking to Tara Murtha, who's the author of Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joe, and the 33 and a Third series. Her career really continued on an upward trajectory. Eventually, she had her own TV show on the BBC.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was the first woman to host a variety show on the BBC. The producer was this gentleman named Stanley Dorfman, and they had done one of those specials, you know, one-offs for BBC that like Joni Mitchell and all those people did, and they got together to do this show. I've interviewed Stanley, and he made it abundantly clear that Bobby was, in fact, a co-producer and that she, you know, didn't just perform and host, but that she really like conceived the show, the tone of the show, helped select guests, try to figure it out. And she had talked about being interested in TV from early on, and there were talks with U.S. execs about a variety show. But at the end of the day, they just didn't think that a woman could carry a show. And that is despite, you know, the success of Carol Burnett the time. But Carol Burnett got her show. She had a little clause in her contract that said that she was able to ask for something kind of like a reserved, like a, you know, back pocket ask. And she pulled that out and said, well, it says right here that I can, you know, try to do this. And, you know, she really had to advocate for herself and maneuver to get her show as well. But she did, she did three seasons in the BBC. Once she got to CBS, you know, I interviewed some people that were part of the show in the production, and it was just really uptight. They really wanted to go in like a sort of hee-haw, like play up Southern in like a, not in a sophisticated way, you know?
What was typical of country music
in the presentation. Yeah, real like hayseed kind of stuff, you know, that she was obviously not into. And then they even came down, the suits quashed a few skits, you know, Bobby's dancers, which were the dancers that she performed with in her live shows, did this really cool number where they were the Andrews sisters, and they're male dancers in nurse uniforms. And, you know, the CBS executives apparently went nuts and thought that, yeah, she was really pretty gender transgressive in a lot of ways. I mean, it's kind of funny because it's her gender performance is invisible when it's like super hyper femininity, which is a mode that she did perform a lot. She was teeny tiny, so she wore these 4-inch heels and all that, was hyper feminine. But she also did that kind of stuff, did Elvis in drag with the pompadour and short hair and everything. You know, she was pretty clear. I mean, if she was performing today, it would be pretty obvious that part of her artistic vision was questioning the performance of gender by hyper performing gender. But nobody thought that way at the time. You know, they just thought it was wild.
But she had a mutual admiration society with Elvis too, didn't she?
She did. And, you know, it's really bizarre parallel, really, you know, both coming poor kids from Mississippi who wind up these, you know, celestial stars and out on the Vegas Strip at the same time. And so she did this Elvis performance, which I have on film, and is just magnificent. And she's in this skin tight, glittering white suit, and she embodies his movements, you know, really, but where she leans back and slowly unfurls the silk scarf and throws it into the crowd and does this whole Elvis medley. And he heard about it and came into the show, you know, and that's how they became friends. And then her and a small group of friends after her shows would go over, you know, to the Hilton and hang out with Elvis. And it's been up for a wild debate how intimate they were, but you know, it's a pretty wild scene picturing Bobby sitting around with an acoustic guitar jamming with Elvis and Tom Jones in Vegas, right?
It's funny, though, you mentioned Elvis, like, you know, peeling his scarf off and people would go crazy. But a woman does that and it's, you know, scandalous. And it speaks to some of the things you've mentioned. In 1969, Gentry releases an amazing song called Fancy, and that's a young woman looking back on her life. Can you tell our listeners about that song if they don't know it?
Sure. Fancy is another story song, and it's also from sang and written from the point of view of a young girl. In this case, the narrator is just turning 18, and her mom, you know, they're living in poverty. The big line is the baby's going to starve to death, you know, And her mom kits her out in a slinky red dress that's iconic now. It's the cover of the record actually is a portrait of Bobby Gentry in this tight little red dress that she painted herself from her own portrait.
I've seen that cover.
Yeah, pretty iconic image. And in the song, you know, it's her mother, the chorus is her mother saying, "Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down," and basically turns her out, you know, has her keep taking gentleman callers in exchange for some economic security. And by the end of the song, she's pouring tea in a Georgia mansion and says, "And I ain't done bad," you know, pretty defiantly. It's interesting, in her Vegas performances, she would go all out on that song and double down, even though it was scandalous at the time. The song was, of course, the implication that she's a prostitute was pretty scandalous, you know, and or playing the role of a prostitute in the song even. But instead of backing down from that and saying, "Oh, it's a metaphor for the music industry," which is what her friends have told me, you know, they're like, I mean, that's her song about her experience in showbiz, you know, but instead of kind of getting coy about all that, she like doubled and tripled down and would come out on stage swinging around a pole inside a giant glittering bird cage, right? That spirals out onto stage.
Wow.
And then it kind of, she kind of disappears. And then you hear that bass line of the down, down, you know, the light comes up and she just descends a spiral staircase singing Fancy. Actually, in some cases, she's singing House of the Rising Sun into Fancy. So even like being super explicit. And she adds a little line at the end. And, you know, after the ain't done bad, she throws the boa around her neck and says, "My name is Fancy and I'm not ashamed and I do it again." And that's the big ending. You know, I mean, a giant F you, you know, to like the idea of people being so uptight and judgmental and literal. And
it seems to me like 180 degrees from Ode to Billie Joe, though, in terms of a strong woman in the song, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum, but a very Southern perspective still.
You know, I can see what you mean. Both of the songs are about disillusionment, right? That's like the main theme of Bobby Gentry's entire songbook. Like half of the songs about disillusionment are about the South and the deep dive into Southern culture and of like the Ode to Billie Joe style. And the other half later on, she still is exploring the themes of disillusionment and feeling responsibility toward others that she wants to be liberated from. And but in the context of Hollywood, or in case of Fancy, I mean, slightly adjusted Hollywood, like the metaphor of Hollywood, you know.
Right.
So I don't really see them that opposite in point of view, though they're different in storytelling. And weirdly, or wildly, Warner Brothers, after the film Ode to Billie Joe came out, she wrote a script for Fancy as a movie. And Warner Brothers had a vision of producing it as a sequel to Ode to Billie Joe. So the story of the narrator and Fancy, they thought, could be made into the part two of kind of where the girl in Ode leaves off, which is pretty wild to think about.
You're listening to All Music Podcasts, a member of Pantheon Media. We're talking to Tara Murtha, who's the author of Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billie Joe, and the 33 and a Third series. So Bobby Gentry is a very attractive woman, a great songwriter, a great singer, an astute businesswoman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty rare in the industry at that time.
I mean, I don't think so. As people, being rare to be able to showcase all that together was rare. People have always been able to be wildly attractive and wildly intelligent, right? It's unfair, but it's true.
Right. No, I guess what I meant was, you know, you had mentioned Hee Haw earlier.
Yeah.
And her presentation was clearly her own vision.
Yeah, yeah. She stopped short of saying, "Poor me, I'm so beautiful." But it really blew my mind, some of the early articles about her when she first came on the scene, and how blatantly disrespectful they were because she was so beautiful. I mean, here she was, a woman who, you know, girl out of Mississippi who, for all they know, walked into Capitol Records and put out this song that knocked the Beatles out of number one, right? And they put her, quote, Miss America measurements and would literally guess the number of inches that her waist and hips were. So she was certainly treated that way. Yeah. And she stopped short of, and she never spoke about a pity party or anything like that. But she did say that it was frustrating that beauty was supposed to negate intelligence and that it was tough to be a female. She wrote, you know, she describes herself as a female composer and producer, which she was, in working in this all male industry in environment, you know, which it pretty much was at the time.
Right. And as that feminist writer and artist, I think you could see the ripples after her, you know, of influence, certainly in country music, but all music genres.
Oh, yeah. It almost collapses even the kind of point of genre. It's interesting the way gender plays out in the context of like selecting genres, too. I mean, she considered herself a pop composer that wrote about some personal and country regional things. She didn't think of herself as, quote, a country singer. In that context, some of the struggle that she had is that we see it still today, that there's this assumption a lot of times about female songwriters that whatever they wrote has to be autobiography. It's not like craft that is inspired from their experiences or personal life, you know. And, you know, you see female artists getting quizzed about this all the time, to a much greater extent, you know, less scrutiny than male writers do. And it's this sort of passive assumption that there's not an artistic process there, that you're just like writing your, you know, confessional diaries. Pretty interesting to see so acutely there and then still see it 50 years later.
So in 1983 or so, Bobby Gentry, poof, she's gone. We don't see her again. And I read an interview with you where you said that she flipped the script on fame.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that, what you mean by that? Because I think in your looking for her, you could not turn her up for your book.
You know, she did not let the persona live her life. She flipped the script because she actually remained Bobby Gentry, her, you know, stage name that she assigned herself around 18 years old or 14 years old, and took what she needed out of the industry and then just kept going. So she got what she needed to get out of it. That was what motivated her to go to Vegas and reinvent herself as a way both to continue being an artist, but to make money. It's pretty cool that she never played the game and about not being interested in making money either. She's like, I'm talented. I've been training from the time I was a kid to be in entertainment. And she explicitly would say freedom is financial freedom as well, you know, that that's necessary for her life. So even though she got mistreated, certainly, in a lot of ways. In the end, she didn't just keep going and let it drain her.
She won.
She won. She left on top.
Thanks for appearing with us, Tara. I'd like to tell everyone listening that the Bobby Gentry book is amazing. We'd love to have you back on when you got another book out.
Hey, right on. Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
Well, thanks for going backwards in time with us for this episode of In Case You Missed It. We're going to try and keep this going every other week. And don't forget, if your app only shows you 20 episodes or so at a time, check out our brand new mobile-friendly website, allmusicpodcast.com, where all of our shows are instantly available at your fingertips.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.